Welcome along to a Tuesday edition of the Huddle Breakdown. James here hosting once again, and I'm back with my good friend Alan Morrison from Celtic by Numbers, and we're here to have a nice little discussion about the victory over St. Mirren from Sunday, 2-0 at Paisley on one of the most pristine pitches in the history of the universe. So, Alan, let's get right into it. You've already done your thing. You've done your rewatch. You've captured all your data. So what are your impressions from, the result being self-evident, but any shifts in what the kind of trend and performance dynamics have been?
Yeah, listen, I mean, brilliant. I mean, we were the underdogs, apparently. You know, going to get, according to some respected commentators, we're going to get absolutely shafted. So, listen, it's all good. Yeah. You know, we talked about, you know, last week, you know, to get back to more serious matters, we talked about, you know, result over performance. And I actually thought, honestly, you know, as a performance, this was pretty decent. We asked for change, we got change. So that's one thing. So listen, we can get into that as well as we go on, in terms of, you know, we moved away from the sort of 4-3-3. We played a more of a 4-2-3-1. Kyogo playing as a pretty much out and out number 10. So four attacking players, O'Reilly playing a deeper role. So that was a change to the shape that we've played in 99% of the games probably over the last 3 years, really. So we asked for that. We got that. So let's have a look at.
Thanks
that.
A lot, Alan. That's your fault.
Well, you asked for 4-2-3-1, I believe. I was asking for 4-4-2. I think Brendan was quite pointedly pointing out before the game that, you know, they'll continue to play 4-4-2 without the ball, which is fine. And that's true. That is true. Celtic do play 4-4-2 without the ball. With the ball, it was a 4-2-3-1 mainly. And I think that had some interesting impacts on certain individual performances. But also, I think there was a lot of other factors that came into play for the game. One would be just the whole attitude of St. Mirren. You know, it was a cup tie. You ended up with, actually, I imagine for a neutral, 37 shots at goal across the two teams, split mainly 50-50. And in that sense, you know, really good cup tie. They approached the game to go out to win it. They didn't sit back. They didn't bunker down. They didn't play a low block. You got to give them credit for that. They really felt that they could exploit Celtic's weaknesses, and that mainly came predictably through, you know, set pieces and long balls and the high crosses into the box, of course. But they did have a go. They absolutely did have a go. And then the other thing that I think that was very different, I suppose, to how an SPFL match might have gone, was they didn't choose to man-mark Callum McGregor. And actually, McGregor ended up pretty much controlling the whole game. I mean, he absolutely, dominated the game. I think he had 17 or 19 more successful passes than any other Celtic player on the pitch from that central midfield position. He was allowed to really dictate the tempo of the game. And actually, a lot of the best chances from Celtic came from him playing early passes. And that's another thing that we'll get into, I think, which is that a lot of Celtic's best chances didn't come from building pressure, but they came from counterattacks and came from breaking on St. Mirren, who had committed players forward. So this was a very different game to a league game. And actually, I think in some ways, the approach that St. Mirren took kind of played into Celtic's hands. So what does that tell us about the rest of the season? I'm not really sure. But I think Celtic played a very good game overall and deservedly won. I think, as I say, I had the XG down as around about 3.15 to 1.2 or something like that. So it was almost a two-goal difference. I think it was, in that respect, at least, it was a kind of fair result, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah, I'm probably a little less optimistic, and we chatted a little bit before recording here, and I'll get into it in a little bit more depth as we go along here. But as to why, I mean, what I'm trying to figure, because I agree with you, like the obvious context of St. Mirren playing like it was a cup tie, we can discuss and debate where the relative wisdom of that. It's not how I would set up if I was them. I mentioned last week what I think is almost a gross negligence level of tactics for an opposition not to man mark Cal McGregor, given his importance in our buildup and prominently relative to the counterattack. I mean, that's exactly. I mean, they did have a go. They were on the front foot quite a bit. Don't have the quality to really punish us in doing that, and basically gave Cal McGregor free rein to do whatever the heck he wanted in limited buildup because we didn't have to, and just pummeling them on the counterattack. So whereas I thought Montgomery was relatively smart last week at Hibs, I would give Robinson, I'll be generous and say a C-minus in what he set up to kind of challenge us on Sunday. But I just want to, because I think one of the things I did, because it was such a weird game in that regard, meaning that it was, I didn't expect them to set up that way. Oh. And given the context of how they did set up, I was probably a little deflated by how things went. And I'll give some numbers behind that. If you look at the proximity to our box, and absolutely, I mean, I said before we went live, this was almost like a 2-0 win at Livingston. And I think the pitch played a big part in that, meaning that you have this kind of, as Rogers has talked about, the basketball game that's kind of breaking out a little bit when we're playing right now, and he doesn't like that, and I understand that as far as relative to control. And I think it, given how they tried to play, yes, I mean, they're obviously not going to be Atletico Madrid or somebody like that, but their ability to win second balls and what buildup they did have and their ability to play long was closer to that, meaning that it was like this weird hybrid between at Livingston, which again, I think the pitch impacted, but also like the level of possession and touches and entries into our box that Atletico Madrid had in the 6-0 when they beat us. Obviously, they're completely different, but that to me was what was concerning, is that on a sliding scale, they actually did enough to get a draw, meaning that, yes, it's obviously not a league game. Obviously, it's a cup game. But what they did, if other teams pursue that, if they have really a little bit better decision making, and for example, man marking McGregor. Like I see some causes for concern where I didn't have them before, and I think that it's a natural progression. And this is where we talk about constantly about these layering of risks, and we didn't have too many risks manifest in the game in that regard, meaning that for the most part, their finishing wasn't good, despite having a couple of pretty good chances that, as they say on another day, this is what we always talk about. Once opposition get up over that one in XG, those are the games that we drop points in, just because of either the opposition keeper has a worldie or some kind of weird variance in finishing where we have an off day, opposition finishes a couple of chances, the Kilty goal, two finishes, one of them an overhead kick from 16 yards. I mean, that's not one that's usually going to go in, but the other one that Gagic had was one that very easily could have been kind of a top shelf finish. That's, we're talking about, as we always talk about, we're talking about fine margins here. Like this is us against St. Mirren in any scenario, 9 times out of 10, we're going to win the game, and probably 8 to 8.5 times is going to be comfortable. And I think this certainly fit in that comfortable characterization, but with some areas of anxiety that I have that are lingering. And again, this is not in isolation. Like we've been talking about some of the issues in recent weeks and really all this season. So that was kind of my initial impressions and context. Let's get into maybe a little bit more on the individual player side. You already mentioned McGregor. I agree. I mean, he was kind of at his orchestral best in directing play. Anyone else stand out to you?
Yeah, I think Bernabei's performance was noteworthy. Probably nothing new in terms of what we would expect from him. I think most people came away from the game, what I could see, with kind of positive feelings about how he'd played. But actually, when you break it down, it was an atypical Bernabei performance. I mean, he's remarkable as a player in some respects. You know, he was involved in the most challenges in the whole game, 17. He lost 7 of them, which was more than anyone else. He had the most recoveries, 18. He had the most turnovers, 6. And he had the most losses of the ball in the defensive third, 5. But he also won the ball back in the defensive third most, 4. He lost possession overall 9 times, which is the most, by 5, actually. I mean, like by not even close. He created 2 chances. He had 2 secondary assists, with the highest expected assists associated with him of anyone in the team. He had the most progressive runs in the team and the highest pack dribbling score. And he had the highest pack receiving score of any player in the team. So, that's just mad, right? And I think I joked to you before that if you look at most players, they'd fit within a sort of normal distribution of performance. Bernabei is like a canyon. All of his stats are either at one extreme or the other of the margins. He's either brilliant or he's awful. And this was atypical of that. He's just a fascinating player. I've never known a player like this play for Celtic. You know, I think he didn't get punished for the things that he did badly. So, you know, and you know, he generally contributed well in the final third. So I think there was probably generally positive sentiment with his performance. But then you think of like that sort of two-footed lunge he made when he could have gone really badly wrong. I mean, he was unfortunate, right? I mean, he was fouled. That was the first thing. He should have been given the foul.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But then, you know, this is the emotional side of his game, where by being disappointed at not getting the foul, he dives in to that challenge, both feet on the ball, but that was a fraction of a second from being a straight red card. And then the whole game could potentially change at that point. And as I say, some real positives in what I've said. Some of his dynamic running down the wing was fantastic. And you just want to keep, it's a little bit like Hitate in the sense, you want to keep him as far away from your own goal as you possibly can, right? And this is, you know, Bernabei, you don't want him near your own goal, really. As much as he's really tenacious in the challenge, and he as I say, he won the ball back in his own defensive third more than any other player in the team on the day. And that's why you just think, well, probably wing back or you know, almost like a defensive winger type, but you don't want him as a fullback. It's just weird, but yeah, his performance was remarkable, as I say, for many reasons. So he was the one that really kind of stood out for me.
So how did you? And I haven't rewatched the game, so I don't have that perspective. I haven't had time since Sunday with the quick turnaround for us here. But what was your thoughts, or what are your thoughts on Rodgers' pivot? Meaning that his decision to go the way that he did, I think, is very interesting. Personally, not a fan of it, and we can get into that. But you know, having rewatched the game, how did you think? Because actually, and again, as you know, by watching thousands of hours of these games, trying to set what the actual formation of a team is, yes, you know,
it's a framework,
a fluid thing.
Yeah, I keep saying it's a framework. It's not a rigid. It's a framework. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think with the difference between defending 4-4-2 and him, you know, the way we set up is kind of 4-2-3-1, mush all that together. And Wyscout had it as a 4-4-1-1, which if you think about it, it's about, you know, kind of a hybrid of those two things. So how do you think how he ended up setting up actually worked out? Were you a fan? Pluses, minuses?
Ooh. I mean, so I saw a lot of comment after the game about, oh, O'Reilly, it's another poor performance. But if you actually look at his cumulative performance over the 90 minutes, you know, he had a really, really good game. I mean, he played a different role. He played a, let's call it a sort of continuity. He was a continuity player. He wasn't a dynamic final third player. He was a continuity player. He did his bit defensively. So, for example, whereas McGregor, who I thought was man of the match for me, whereas McGregor was 4-6 for successful and unsuccessful challenges, O'Reilly was 4-2. O'Reilly had one less recovery, but he had four pack recoveries. So these are recoveries where the opposition have got players wrong side of the ball. He had four of those, which was equal with Ralston, best of the team. He didn't have any turnovers, O'Reilly, on the day. He won the ball back twice in his defensive third. So his defensive side of the game was excellent. He didn't get on the ball so much, but he still ended up... I give him an assist for his shot because I use the old fantasy football rules whereby if you have a shot at goal and it either comes off the post and then is put in or it comes off the goalkeeper and goes in, I count that as an assist. And then he created two other chances as well. So that side of it, you know, he was pretty effective. Three progressive runs, which was sort of second highest in the team. He still did manage to get, he actually got the equals. Actually, behind Bernabe, he had the second highest pack receive score of the game and actually had the highest packing score in the whole, even, it was three ahead of McGregor. I just had McGregor as overall because of the way he controlled the tempo of the game. So O'Reilly was fantastic in that double pivot role, just not as eye-catching, I suppose, as what people are used to. So I think that bit of it was a success. Those two together, I think, is a really strong pairing. But then we can probably talk about, well, why did we give away so many chances? But then the downside of it to me is you've then got four players ahead of those two who are not really on the ball very much. And that to me is a problem as well. I mean, Kyogo had probably his second most, he was on the ball. He was on the ball the second most he's been this season almost, because he was playing that slightly deeper role. And he scored his goal by making a deep run. And it was a nice pick out from Palmer, actually. He did have a look. He picked him out and then it was a strong finish. That was excellent, and that broke the game. I mean, until the 15th minute, St Mirren were excellent. I mean, we can talk about Celtic weaknesses, but I think you have to give St Mirren credit for the way they played in that opening 15 minutes. And then that goal completely took the air out of them for quite some time. And Kyogo, you know, being in that deeper position, ran onto the ball. But, you know, Maeda was... I know he scored that second goal, but it's almost a man down, really, playing him on the right wing like that. To me, what are we getting out of that?
He scored a good striker's goal.
He did, and he was in the great position. He was in a superb position, right in the middle of the 6-yard box, which is where I'd like to see him. That's where I'd like to see him. I think he's great in that position. You know, outside of that, you know, he's what is he contributing really? I mean, he's, you know, 13 passes, but of which, you know, how many are pack passes? I'm just checking now. It's like
I can't remember,
like
one.
Two, right? So out of the front four players, you've got like five pack passes the whole game. So you're just not getting that kind of same level of creativity really with that sort of formation. But you did ask for a 4-2-3-1 last week's show, I do believe.
I did, but not with that mix. Right. You know, I posted this on Twitter, and I didn't know. Like, I had to look it up. I sensed it had been a small number, but, you know, again, usual caveat that the data quality is fluid and these things are not precise. But Y-Scout has, I think it's 12,300 minutes of data on Kyogo. Most of it, obviously, in Japan, but also, obviously, at Celtic. And out of that, going into this game, he had less than 400 minutes coded as a number 10. Mm. And I think what's interesting, not surprising, but interesting is that Rodgers' impulse to change it up was to try to use Kyogo in that role, meaning that when he's had success in his career, he's been either a left winger in Japan or a striker, obviously prominently with us. So to drop him into that kind of number 10 role, to me, speaks to how anchored Rodgers is in width, meaning that his natural inclination was, okay, I'm going to try something different here. Let me double down on width. And rather than, you know, try something more narrow. And I think that's where I'm. And when I my thinking on the 4-2-3-1 was largely an expectation that he wasn't going to go narrow. And we talked about that last week. I mean, and we don't really have the center backs right now to play three at the back. So it's, you know, there aren't a lot of options as far as going narrow, playing four at the back. So yeah, I would not have thought of playing Kyogo in that 10 role. And I agree. Like, generally, I don't think the front four worked. I mean, you put McGregor and O'Reilly in those two positions, I would think that's going to do very well. And the fact that St. Mirren played the way they did, I think, made that easier for us to do that. But I just don't think that I think it spoke volumes that most of our threat was on the counterattack against St. Mirren.
Yeah. That's true.
Right. I mean, to me, that's an indictment as to how it didn't work versus, because to the point of our conversation, the likelihood is that we're not going to be a counterattacking team for the remainder of the 13.
And counterpressing. I mean, we were actually really, games. Really strong counterpressing. And a strong, again, that's a really strong, that front four and O'Reilly, that's a strong counterattacking and counterpressing unit. But again, that actually worked and actually, upset St. Mirren. They couldn't get out on occasion, especially in the first half. They couldn't get out. They lost the ball in their own third quite a lot. But it's not. Well, it's not what we're going to come up against. It's not what we're going to come up against.
Yeah, and this is where we get into the kind of the underlying driver of my anxiety coming out of this game is that if you look at St. Mirren's style of play in the game, they were more possession-centric, less direct than they typically are, and by not a small margin, meaning that they were like 25% less intensive in going long ball, right? So this was not – so obviously they're still going long. It's a relative thing. So they're not playing like Hibs do or, presumably Hearts will, at least on the margin. But they were a lot closer to them than they normally are. And they were a lot closer to them than St. Johnston or, and the fact that, of course, we were going to give them problems, them trying to build out from the back, their keeper trying to play it short and all this other stuff. Like, again, I just think Robinson was out to lunch on some of the stuff, but I don't think we made them pay enough. I mean, given they played this way, outside of, what would you say? I mean, we basically had two really good chances in the game.
We did, but I think one of the things that people highlighted after the game was, as I said, there was like something like 35 shots and they may have had one more than Celtic, but the average expected goals per shot was astonishing. It was, for Celtic, it was 0.18 per shot, right? And for them, it was 0.08. Yeah. So almost 0.1 per shot Celtic had better. And that was the same with expected assists. That was the same with the chances created because virtually all of their chances came from crosses or corners. In fact, their 11 corners is equal the most any team has had against Celtic since I started collecting data. 11 corners is the most. And on top of the 11 corners, they had 22 crosses, which is a high number. So that was all their chances were coming from that sort of situation, which results in a header under challenge or a ball falling in the box where there's loads of bodies in front of you, etc. These are not good chances. Now, I agree with you. That's like they created a huge volume of those, and on another day, a couple of those could have gone in, and it would have been a very different game. But that's not through quality; that would be through just the way things go, right? And in a cup tie, that's what can happen. So, what's more concerning for me is this is the third game in a row that Celtic have conceded over.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
We're 1 XG, but actually we're averaging over 1 XG against 1.11 in all game across all games this season, and that's too high. And my concern is that we're just too easy to play against. I mean, St Mirren, for God's sake, they're not a passing team, and yet they had the second highest packing score ever domestically in a team that I've seen. In fact, if you look at the pack passing, just take pack passing outside of derby matches, this was the sixth highest pack passing score since I started collecting that sort of data. If St Mirren are playing through your lines that easily, then there's something awry here. To say how effective our pressing, counter-pressing is, to say how we're limiting them to crosses and what have you, yet still, having said all of that, why are we so easy to play against?
Yeah, and that, you're striking right at the heart of, I probably haven't done as good a job explaining why I've got this anxiety. And that's so, again, back to numbers, the second highest amount of crosses that I have that I see in Y-Scout this year is that 6-0 Atletico Madrid loss. Mm. Right. So again, not claiming that they were anywhere
near the quality of chance.
The quality.
Yeah, you've not got Alvaro Morato on the end of them either.
Yeah, so they tried to kind of play like Atletico Madrid did, only they don't have Griezmann. And it was disturbing to me how successful they were on a relative basis in some components, like you're talking about with your pack passing and related score. Like just from a real estate perspective and a control perspective, like those are the two kind of
But James, again, listen, it's a cup. So two things on that, right? That which I'll just say to mitigate quickly. One is it's game state, right? It was a cup tie. If you look at the shot distribution, it's actually almost incredible. If you look at the first 30 minutes, it's almost all St Mirren apart from Celtic's goal. Then you look at between the 30th minute and the 60th minute, it's almost all Celtic. Then they get and in that time, Celtic get the second goal. So it's a cup tie. They're 2-0 up. They're comfortable with that. Then between the 60th minute and the 80th minute, it's all St Mirren shots, right? But they're all low value. And then from the 80th minute to the end, Celtic see it out with ease. So if I were to articulate the game in that sense, it becomes a very sort of a comfortable game. Yeah.
100%. And again, this is why
that lens of game state, right?
And that's why I wanted to stress this. It's a weird nuance comparing.
I'm with you. Yeah.
So it's a question of all the risks that we've talked about in recent months, and the potential for these to manifest. Because again, we were talking before we went live here, not live, but recording here, is we're down to 13 league matches, and hopefully two. Three cup games, and this is probably a race outside of the two derbies. It's probably a race of one or two games dropping points. I mean, that's it. So it's a question of, with normal variance, normal luck, normal Yorkshire Whistler. It's one game away to Kilmarnock post split, where you get a 0-0 or a 1-1. I mean, that might be what is the determinant of the league at this point. So the fact that, again, he played very well on Sunday, was Joe Hart, and he made one very good save. I don't think it was quite as good as everyone's making it out to be, but it was a good save. In 13 games, Joe Hart is not going to lay an egg 13 times. Of course not. He only has to do it once. He only has to do it once or twice in making a material error that could be the difference between winning the league and losing the league. And that's, you know, what I'm kind of hammering away at is that there were elements of the performance, how, to your point, how easy it was on a relative basis for St. Mirren to play the way that they did, even if it was only for 30 minutes and, you know, cut us open to a degree with their players, kind of like what Bodo Glimt did in transition a couple of times. You know what I mean?
I think there was a couple of occasions where St. Mirren worked the ball wide and then one pass in behind. And it's like, it's 1v1.
Takes everybody out.
How did that even? So I get it on the left because Bernabe, who the hell knows where Bernabe is? But I don't get it.
I don't think he knows where he's at.
Why are the two centre-backs not together? Why is Ralston... If Bernabe's doing Bernabe things, and nobody knows what that is, why isn't Ralston at least being conservative and tucking in on the other side, right? There were a few occasions where it was like, how did we get into this situation? How did we get here? How did that happen? You know, there was a few of those. Listen, it was a really, really fiery pitch. The pitch was awful. It looked great.
Brutal.
It played terribly. The ball was bobbling around. And what it highlighted is that especially, actually not Bernabe technically on the ball. Once he's got his head right, he's pretty decent. The other three, Ralston, Welsh and Scales, oh my God. I mean, it's, you know, a difficult bouncing ball or a fiery pitch, it just accentuates the time they need to get the ball under control. And this is, listen, I'm talking about fractions of seconds here. I'm not talking about, you know, but at this level, against St. Mirren, it looked a bit hairy at times. Against Hearts, it'll look worse. You know, against the Rangers, it'll be even, you know, slightly worse than that. So this is why this is important, is if you're going to put that back three, back four under pressure, you know, and then playing the ball across to Hearts, right, like a yard off the goal line. It's all of that, but it's more than that. It was just the time. They just don't move quick enough, and that's a fundamental. It's a fundamental intrinsic issue that is. We speak about quality, but sometimes quality is a physical thing. It's not a decision-making thing. I don't think that Anthony Ralston, on the whole, makes bad decisions. I don't think Stephen Welsh, on the whole, makes bad decisions. They just simply don't react quick enough. You know, to be as dominant as Celtic have to be at this level, these are not players that either think or move quick enough. And I'm talking about fractions of seconds. And on a pitch, so one of the ways that this manifests itself in a material way that I can actually, you know, perhaps articulate better is in aerial challenges. Liam Scales isn't a small player, he's 6'3" or whatever he is. I know Welsh isn't particularly tall, but they do win aerial challenges. But okay, I can go up and I can win the ball. There's two different ways I could win the ball, let's say, if I want to simplify it. There's a dominant aerial win, which is I win the ball and it bloody gets won and the ball goes up the pitch. And then there's I win the ball and it goes who the God knows where. And one of the problems that Celtic had on the other is that Welsh and Scales were troopers. They were up against their man. They were challenging. They were winning more often than not, their aerial duels, but a lot of those challenges ended up in throw-ins deep or corners or you know, deep in Celtic's half. And that just adds to the pressure. So it's not just about winning the ball in the air. It's not just about timing your jump and being that bit quicker and using your body intelligently. It's about doing it in a way that's dominant so that you clear the ball from your defense. You don't just win it and it goes God knows where. And that, I think, is the problem. Because to articulate that into precise numbers, you know, the average Celtic center half in the time I've collected data wins 82% of aerial duels. Okay, and that means winning the ball. It doesn't say where the ball ends up. Scales is on 80%. Welsh is on 79%. That sounds like it's very close to the average. But that is further enough away from the average that it creates secondary risk. in terms of the ball isn't clear. The ball's not won dominantly, because the ones at the top of that list, your Van Dijks, your Ayers, your Julians, etc., your Duffy, even Duffy, because Duffy was, you know, obviously aerially dominant, right? He had other issues. They're at like 88%, right? They're like 8% above the average. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it's massive in the terms of professional football. So these are the things which I think, you know, it didn't matter. It didn't hurt Celtic in the end in this game. But these small things, which are about timing, about anticipation, about physicality, not just of being tall, but about leaping and having that physicality to clear the ball out. These are the things that Celtic's defence lack at the moment. And that's the real, I think, you know, I think that's where a lot of the opposition chances are coming from. It's not the fact that they're making mistakes. It's the secondary risks, because the ball isn't cleared, and therefore the corners come, the throw-ins come, and you get all this secondary action.
I think that is a great point, and it very much fits with a couple of the metrics I was looking at that, you know, just jaw-dropping when I went through the summary of the game. Because, again, it's this weird hybrid of, you know, their number of entries into our box, for example.
Yeah, it was high. Very high.
For the point that you're saying that they had the ball out, or they clear it and it's a long throw, which again is just another sequence of play that can get into the mixer and turn into chaos, and a ball dribbles out to Gogic and he, you know, scores from 16 yards potentially. That it's that kind of fine margin. And to put this into perspective, they had 31, again, in this usual caveat, this is what Y-Scout had. They had 31 entries into our box. Feyenoord, in the 2-0 when we were down to 9 men, had 35, right? So you're in the neighborhood of just volume of the ball going into our box. You know, normally we're talking about in games where we're dominant, it's in like low teens to 10, high single digits, you know, against bottom six, like financial resource teams. I mean, St. Mirren's been punching above their wage bill a little bit this year, to their credit. But again, that's the degree with which some of these issues that you're talking about are manifesting were so significant. Another one I think really highlights specifically what you're talking about was clearances. Ooh, they had the game at 39 clearances for Sutton. That's not out of the box. That's out of the defensive third. Yeah. That's along the lines like what we had against Barcelona when we lost 6-0. Well, it's 16-17.
So on that one, right? So I agree with you, and that was a noteworthy. I had it as 42. I had it 42. It's the highest domestically outside games against Aberdeen, Hearts, and the Rangers, and it's the highest in 4 years in terms of just the sheer volume of clearances. Now there's two aspects to that. One is that indicates being under pressure. Okay. Because it means you don't have the time to bring the ball down and or you don't have the time to try and find a pass, right? But the second thing is on the positive side, I would say, is that it does indicate a sort of clarity and a decisiveness in terms of we weren't trying to be overcomplicated in our own defensive third. It was a trap. Pitch was fiery. The ball was bouncing all over the place. We weren't trying to be too clever about it. If the ball was there and there wasn't an obvious pass on, we just got rid. Now, I think that was smart in the conditions, to be honest with you. So I think there's a little bit of both there.
Agreed.
Right? If that's fair.
100%. Yeah, and I only raised the numbers because how outlier they were. Yeah, I mean, they were kind of crazy. Because it's not as if we don't play a large number of games on bad pitches against St. Mirren type of competition, and you know, the vast majority of those do not result in 42 clearances. And that's, you know, this is where I go back to, you know, the wrist, which is if Robinson had just man-marked McGregor, like just made that decision, I would have been a lot more nervous in this game because, you know, that he was so seminal in relieving what pressure they were putting on us. So we were either going long or going to McGregor. And, you know, if I'm St. Mirren, I think they made a really unwise decision to allow that release valve because, I mean, when you're playing the way that they were playing, the whole thing is about second balls. And I mean, it's a dream scenario for you if the conditions are such that Celtic go long all the time. I mean, you want chaos. You want, you know, balls in midfield where people are flying around. I mean, that's a far better environment for them than, you know, McGregor being on the ball and in control. Okay, well, let's not beat a dead horse here. We're running over about 40 minutes. So, and any other thoughts on how we were set up, how the game manifested? Any other conclusions to draw as we go forward to the Baker's dozen that we have left here in the 13 league games?
No, I mean, I think I was probably pretty upbeat about it, mainly because, as I say, although all the issues that we've discussed absolutely hold true, I think game state had a lot to do with it, and it was a cup tie. St. Mirren, you know, there was no benefit in St. Mirren holding back. They had to go for it. And I think Celtic were generally quite comfortable in defending, albeit with, you know, it could have gone very differently on another day, but it didn't, right? So there you go. I think just a shout out to I think especially Bacchus on the St. Mirren side, because he had an eye catching 7-0, as you would say, in turnovers, in terms of he actually recovered the ball. These are pack turnovers, so he's recovering the ball. It means that Celtic players are out of the game 7 times, and he didn't give the ball up in the same scenario at all, which is quite a remarkable set of numbers. And he had the third highest packing score of any player on the pitch on the day. So I thought he really stood out. I thought he was excellent on the day. And the lad, Boyd Munce, I think he created about 5 or 6 chances, and a couple of them from corners, but 5 or 6 chances for St. Mirren as well. He was pretty decent. So just a shout out to a couple of the St. Mirren players that I thought kind of caught the eye, really. But no, listen, we said last week, nothing's changed. It's good to see, you know, in terms of the quality, especially the defending, the extent to which these games are going to be an attritional battle a lot of the time between now and the end of the season, that I think that holds true. We're not going to be sitting here comfortably sat back in our chairs, purring about comfortable performances so much, I don't think. But on the other hand, you know, was that reaction that we wanted to see? Was that we saw some change? We saw a different shape. We saw a battling performance. We saw Welsh, Scales, Ralston, Burnaby absolutely, you know, sweating every inch for the cause, throwing their bodies on the line, blocking shots, blocking crosses, getting their heads to things. We saw all that, right? So listen, that you've got a fighting chance when you see that. Okay, we can talk about the performance metrics. We can talk about the weaknesses and the risks. These things are extant, absolutely. But, you know, we're talking about a team here that seem to be fighting together, seem to be coherent in terms of, you know, all fighting in the same direction. So that gives you hope. And you just hope that as the players come back from injury, as form starts to pick up and what have you, that does hold the team in good stead.
Yeah, what I was probably most encouraged coming out of the game was actually Rodgers after the game. I think his demeanor and, you know, I'll call it in my stereotypical, probably American mentality, bring it on, baby. Right? I mean, he had that air of bunkering, like us against the world type of mentality. And I think that that's a wise path for him to be going right now, for a lot of reasons. My concern is, and this is more paranoia, probably, is that, you know, where's the line between believing his own BS and, you know, how much of it's like rah, rah, this is we're pushing leadership. Good. You know, I would argue good versus like actually believing that some of the issues are not as significant as they are. relative to some of the tactical decisions you make. Like I don't think, like, I don't want to see that 4-2-3-1 again. Like, that to me, that's, I'd have the fear against, you know, the top six teams in the league playing Kyogo in that role, because of what it, I mean, to me, it just left the midfield wide open to a large degree. I mean, I love Kyogo, and he does some of the dropping deep well, but he's not the guy that's going to be winning a lot of those second balls. Kind of like Hatate, like they're going to be over physical, pushed around a little bit domestically, going against some of the big hammer throwers, like against Kilmarnock on the weekend. So I have some worries about that, but. I thought his, because, you know, it's been a bit of a dicey bag this season with his outward confidence and his outward communication, and
well, he seemed understandably, frankly, like, he seemed very passive, frankly, you know, quite
before, yeah.
And so it was. I mean, listen, we're straying into the territory that we say is. Yeah. You know, well over egged, but I think given the context of the season, it was welcome to see him. But I agree with you. I agree that I liked that, but I also want him to be a little bit more reflective to say, actually, some of these things are not going well, and it's in his power, it's in my power, if I was Rodgers, to do something about this, and what am I going to do about it? That's what I want to see. I want to see him problem solve. Players start to come back, he's got a load of tools there, and it's just finding that right combination. And I think credit to him for changing it up against St Mirren. I think the counter-attacking was excellent, but like you say, it's quite the right answer of configuration. I'm looking for the right configuration to get this team over the line for the league. I don't think that was it, but if he's in the mindset where he's willing to at least continue to search for it without making drastic changes, you know, it is tinkering at this stage. It's fiddling, I think, just to find that right best combination. And it might be, as I said last week, it might be horses for courses. It might be horses for courses. And that's fine. You might decide that certain wing play is better suited to certain opposition. That's fine. If we go down that route, at least we're thinking about it. At least we're adapting. At least we're trying to be smart about it. That's all really I can ask for, because, you know, is Palmer going to turn into a consistent player? No, he's not, right? You know, is Kuhn suddenly going to dominate the league, having just arrived from Austria? No, he's not. You know, is Yang going to dominate? No, he's not, right? So is Ida going to turn into a league-winning striker? You know, best will in the world? No, he's not. So all these players have a role to play, and it may be that you fit them into a framework which is fungible depending on the opposition. That to me would be a sensible way forward, perhaps.
We'll leave it at that, because I'm in 100% agreement. So on a positive note, we'll leave it there, because this is now the results, not the performance podcast for the next 3 months, as we are now self-declaring. So thank you, everyone, who tuned in to listen and or watch. If you can hit the like button and subscribe on YouTube, we always appreciate that. Or if you can leave a review on iTunes and or Spotify, we'd appreciate that as well. And I think we might, with the long lost hero of the podcast, may make another appearance late in the week. We'll have to see. We might do a bit of a preview pod late in the week if we can corral the cats and herd the cats.
Yeah, listen, Manchester United have won an away game, so I'm sure Endo will be up for talking about that.
That's right. Yeah. And maybe on Friday we'll get something recorded. We'll see, ahead of the weekend game against Kilmarnock. So thanks again, and we will chat to you later.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.